A More Beautiful Life is a listener-supported show. You can learn more about the benefits you receive from your support, such as access to other courses, special access to tools, blogs, and skills through our Patreon channel, patreon.com/amorebeautifullife. Hello, you are listening to A More Beautiful Life podcast, recognizing, appreciating, and integrating earliest life experiences. My name is Kate White, and I created this podcast because of my passion for my work as a therapist and an educator in preventing and resolving earliest trauma. I believe that integrating our earliest experiences brings us closer to who we really are. On the show, I will be having discussions with others on the path who have explored healing our earliest experiences in life, or who, in my opinion, have found ways to live a more beautiful life. Hello, I'm Kate White, and this is A More Beautiful Life podcast. Today on the show, I'm talking with Michael Trout, who is a beloved figure to many people who work with infants and families. I met him when I worked at the Association for Prenatal and Perinatal Psychology of Health, first in 2004, when I attended our International Congress, and then later when I took stories from his work and integrated them into the Pre and Perinatal Educator Program that I founded and ran for 6 years. Michael Trout completed both his undergraduate studies in philosophy and his graduate studies in psychology in Michigan. He completed his specialized training in infant psychiatry at the Child Development Project, University of Michigan School of Medicine, under the Professor Selma Freiberg. In mental health since 1968 and in private practice since 1979, Mr. Trout directs an institute engaged in research, clinical practice, and clinical training related to problems of attachment. He was the founding president of the Michigan Association for Infant Mental Health and the International Association for Infant Mental Health, and was on the charter editorial board for the Infant Mental Health Journal. He served as vice president for the United States for the World Association for Infant Mental Health, and served on the board of directors and as editor of the newsletter for APPA, the International Society for Prenatal and Perinatal Psychology. In addition to publishing a number of book chapters and journal articles, as well as to the 2005 book co-authored with the foster adopt mother, Jonathan Letters, and the 2008 Baby Verses, the narrative poetry of infants and toddlers, Mr. Trout has produced 16 documentary films that are used in universities and clinics around the world, including 5 films on the unique perspective of babies on divorce, adoption, loss, domestic violence, and parent incarceration. His meditation CD for foster and adoptive parents is entitled The Hope-Filled Parent. He co-authored See Me as a Person on the Nature of the Therapeutic Relationship with Mary Colorudis. His final book, This Hallowed Ground, 4 Decades in Infant Mental Health, was published in 2019. Mr. Trout won the Selma Freiberg Award in 1984 for significant contributions to the needs of infants and their families, and a Lifetime Achievement Award by ATTACH for his decades of work with children of loss and trauma. The most important part of Mr. Trout's work was always in the quiet private practice where he saw families and children of all ages every week. After 46 years, he retired in the summer of 2014. So welcome, Michael. It's so wonderful to have you on the show.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, we've known each other a little while. Like, I remember when I first met you was in 2004 at the APPA Congress in, I think it was San Francisco. Do you remember when we used to have those big conferences there?
Yep, sure do.
And you were a keynote speaker and your hair was all big and brown and...
And more.
And you had your big beard and your lovely voice, and you were very warm and welcome to me. I was a new person at that time to APA's congresses, but not new to the materials. So it was a great congress. I really loved it. Today I would like to talk with you just a little bit about you and about your work and You've just published a new publication. Actually, it's an audio book, and I would like to talk a little about that. And I would also like to talk about some of your other things that you've created. And I love this book, See Me as a Person. Mm-hmm. I would like to talk a little bit about that. Before we get there, if you could just talk a little bit about the early days for you, like how you got started doing this kind of work. And I remember you saying you worked at a mental hospital, but I'm more interested in your work with Selma Freiberg.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I wish I could tell you an organized story about how I sought her out and went to her, but the truth is I stumbled into the library of Selma Freiberg, having worked in a mental hospital for years and a community mental health center for a little while, and was just offered this strange opportunity at the time that she was first starting to think about telling others what she had discovered about blind babies and deafblind babies. She had not quite yet published Insights from the Blind, and she was well known for not liking students. It was very hard to get her to teach a graduate seminar or anything. But she finally agreed with a very important woman in Michigan, and dear to the hearts of many of us in mental health, who was in charge of a lot of money for Department of Mental Health in Michigan, who went to her and said, I would pay you a whole bunch of money if you would take a few people from the Department of Mental Health in Michigan and train them in this new weird stuff you're talking about.
Weird stuff. Like what was the weird stuff?
Well, I mean, babies with souls, babies who think, babies who process, and babies who respond. Mm-hmm. I mean, the theories of attachment we had at the time were not entirely unilateral, but very close. I mean, we knew that attachment was important, but many mothers got the idea that what that meant was they better get cracking. They better get doing this attachment thing. They better love their babies and spend a lot of time with them. And what the babies had to offer to that was not accounted for at all. Mm. So the bilaterality of attachment was not even under consideration.
What year was that?
Oh, the very late 60s, early 70s. And of course, what Freiberg had discovered with studying blind babies and their mothers and fathers was that just take away one ability, like the ability of the infant to regard his mother's face with his own eye, and that changes everything. Mm-hmm. Turns out mothers are not, it's not that they're crippled, but that they certainly have a disability in the attachment. And mothers often didn't acknowledge that. They didn't even know why they felt so at distance from their baby, because they're supposed to just feel sorry for him because he can't see, for goodness sakes. Mm-hmm. But Freiberg helped us to see how the baby's not looking at the mother, and the mother's experience in the baby not looking at her mm-hmm. affected her every move, even the way she approached the crib, much less how she pulled the baby into her arms. Much less how quickly she put him down.
The gaze, the face.
Yeah.
The response of the expressions. That's what that created that sort of reciprocal, synchronous, resonant relationship that really helped forms the basis for our nervous system regulation.
So just spun around in a circle when we nobody had particularly accounted before Freiberg did filming it. Or what would happen if you pick up the baby at a distance, that is to say, you don't regard the baby because you don't want to see again that the baby can't see you, so you look away while reaching for the baby. You pull the baby up into your arms, spin him around without even thinking about it, so he's looking away from you, pull him up on your hip. Nobody thought too much about what that meant for the long-term development of the baby. But it kept going, as it turns out, because then when the mother would put the baby down, some of the babies screamed. And mothers thought the baby was screaming because of her, because the baby somehow knew that she didn't love him or that she didn't savor her time with him. little did we know that babies were screaming, not for those reasons at all, but because since they couldn't see the mother, they couldn't hold a vision of the mother in their minds. So it would later affect object constancy. But right now, it just meant a desperation when mother was starting to put the baby down. The only way the baby could really connect with the mother was with his fingers and his mouth. And if those fingers were pulled away from the mother's neck, it would actually feel to the mother as if the baby was scratching her, which must mean he hates her.
That wow.
It wasn't it at all.
He was just feeling terror or fear.
Exactly.
And really, that's his lifeline was through touch and the feeling of being with.
And what Freiberg would say, as she did in one famous instance in a home visit, she said directly to the baby, "It's okay, Robbie. Mommy will not leave you." Infant mental health was born, at least in my view. That was the first intervention. And I don't think she even meant it as an intervention. She was just trying, as a child psychoanalyst, to understand the baby's perspective on all this and interpret it for the baby. But of course, the mother is listening.
Right.
And the mother is thinking, wait a minute, I thought he hated me. You're suggesting he actually needs me extra? He's scared of losing me?
Yeah, well, who knew that babies were could be have these depth of feelings and emotions and also could really understand and feel this sort of relationally. So wow, that's a very touching story. Like I know that she created the home visiting. I mean, isn't she the one that created home visiting for families?
Well, there were other people doing home visiting in those years, but a child psychoanalyst of her status going into a home, that was just absolutely not only unheard of, but against the rules of psychoanalytic practice.
Against the rules?
Oh, of course.
You don't go into people's homes.
Yeah, you don't even want to let people look at you. You want to sit on a chair behind.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And well, now we know so much more about the relational field and building that up, and the connection is important in the face and the voice, the polyvagal work, as you know, working with states in the nervous system. So, so you became a student of hers. You found your way into her library. She tolerated your presence.
Barely, I think, but yes.
And then she taught you. So you signed up for her. You were a licensed social worker, isn't that right?
I was a social worker, and in Michigan, I could be also licensed as a psychologist at the time. Both of those, oddly enough. But there were only six of us, and we were all supposedly experienced clinicians in the field. I was a moron. I was not only was I young, but I knew nothing. But I got to sit there, and for 2 years. We studied with her under the supervision of one of the psychologists in the group. Mine was an absolutely brilliant clinician by the name of Bill Schaefer. And we were under very strong supervision as well as our class time.
Nice. But then was this man, Bill, did he follow you and help you create the Infant Parent Institute? Could you talk a little bit? Tell us a little bit about how you transitioned from doing that to creating this institute.
Well, at the time I was in training, I was also in a community mental health center in far northwest and lower Michigan. So I was driving back and forth between Ann Arbor and this faraway place. And I later went into private practice in the center of Michigan and had that institute for several years, and then moved in the mid-80s to Illinois for family reasons, and establish the Infant Parent Institute.
Yeah, so tell us more about that, because I would spend, like, I found this sort of perinatal field in 1999. So I started looking for who was doing things, and I found your institute. I would go there all the time to your website, and I would look at it, and I would say, oh, I want to do that. I want to go out there and be with him and do that. And I would look and look and wish I could come out. So tell people more about that institute and how you created it and what it was like.
Well, fortunately, it didn't have to be out of the blue because I had had such an institute in Michigan. But the idea was to combine clinical practice and not entirely a specialized practice. I didn't only see families with babies. I also saw families with preschoolers, and even began slowly to expand that to me in a very naturalistic way to families with foster and adopted children who had experienced loss and trauma earlier on, and eventually began to expand that even to seeing adults who didn't even have babies, but who came to a place, get this, called the Infant Parent Institute for their adult psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. How's that for self-selection?
Interesting.
Often denying, by the way, that their own early experience meant anything, to which I would often respond, so what is it you're doing here? Why did you come to see the baby guy?
Huh. So how did they find you then? Did they just hear, oh, this guy knows a lot about patterns or psyche or wounding trauma?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he can help you.
Is that, so well, they just hear he knows a lot about adoption. Of course, my experience as an adoptee is utterly innocuous, has nothing whatsoever to do with my anxiety or my rage. But what the hell? I'll go see this guy.
Okay. Well, so I found really that you specialized a lot in this adoption and foster care. I mean, when I've seen you speak over and over the years, those were the stories I remember the most of people coming to you, lost, parents lost, trying to figure out how to connect with their foster or adopted children. I mean, sure. That became a real big specialty of yours.
Right? It did. I suppose... In partly in response to the fact that even in the 80s, people still couldn't tolerate very easily, referring agencies, hospitals, pediatricians, even child welfare agencies, mm-hmm. could barely tolerate the idea of a guy who saw babies, and even if I did it with their parents. But they could tolerate the idea that this six-year-old who had already torn up three placements and was going down in this new placement, and the family was desperate, well, maybe he could help those people. And so I began to get more and more referrals for families with children who had had terrible early experience and had gotten no help then. Mm-hmm. At least they could get help now.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, the products that you created, I mean, we at APA, the Association for Prenatal, Perinatal Psychology and Health, a lot of our colleagues, people that taught, like I learned from Myrna Martin, she often used, the baby's voice. You created products that had the baby's voice. I forget is it the Jonathan Letters? There was one before the Jonathan Letters too.
Well, the films that I did with the baby's voices actually came later on, not until the 1990 or so. I'd already made about 10 films before then that were mostly teaching films. Mm-hmm. But I was so frustrated by my inability to catch the attention of judges and child welfare people and even practicing clinicians about how the baby saw the world. And so I decided to take this risk of creating a little film wherein the baby was the feature. Mm-hmm. The baby was the voice in the background with a fuller script, not all of which the baby spoke. And I also always added some music.
Yeah, Scottish music.
No, often, yes. Mm-hmm. And I found that people sort of were captured by that. Yeah. They wouldn't listen to me talk about the baby's experience of the world, but they'd listen to a baby, or at least their attention was caught by the mm-hmm. baby, maybe because of his precious little voice. And so it worked so well the first time I did 5 films that way, mm-hmm. With babies talking about what it feels like for your parents to be in prison, mm-hmm. For your parents to divorce, and so on. Mm-hmm.
Right. Did you have one in particular that you felt particularly strong about? One that of all those films that you felt like was the most listened to, or is there any one that stood out for you?
Well, that wasn't always the same thing. The one by far in a way that was listened to was the one that had to do with foster care and adoption, repeated mm-hmm. placements. It's called Multiple Transitions.
Okay.
And it was ordered probably at a rate of 5 times all the others combined mm-hmm. over the years. It wasn't necessarily the one I thought was the best, but for some reason it captured the attention, maybe because there was such a huge audience of foster and adoptive families, but also the child welfare agencies working with them. Mm-hmm. For some reason it made sense to all those people.
Mm-hmm. So you got into the agency, like, and agencies now afterwards, and they invite you quite a lot to come and make and give trainings to their people, like all over the United States and the world, right?
Yeah, less now that I'm retired, but yes, certainly a lot for a lot of years, yes.
Mm-hmm. And your institute grew. You had quite a few people working there, you say, like people creating research and products and trainings?
Well, I was kind of the product guy. I was mm-hmm. the only one that created the films and the books mm-hmm. and the meditation CDs and so on. But we had a lovely clinical practice and a lovely training institute for about 25 years. People came from around North America to study for a week at a time,
yeah.
or sometimes as many as 8 of those courses a year. And then I had a very small number of trainees each year who would come mm-hmm. to where I was living and live here for a year, mm-hmm. be under supervision and see a certain number of families and so on.
Yeah, I always wanted to come. I would sit there and look at your website and think, oh, one day. You know, I was raising my own children, and now they're just about grown. My youngest one's 15 now. But so, yeah, when I met you for the first time, like I met all my heroes for the first time, really, in 2004. And that's when I met Myrna also.
Yeah, you would have had some explaining to do if you'd left your babies for a year to go study with the baby guy.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. But I was pregnant with my second baby when I met you. And yeah, so I've been listening and watching, and just, I mean, there are some things that you taught that one of them I learned from Myrna that I picked up and have carried on and taught at the APA education department when I was there, and that's the angels in the nursery. Aunt Rosie, searching for Aunt Rosie, and I love that story, and I wanted to know if you could share just a little bit about it, because when you shared it with our students at APA, you talked about yourself and you talked about how the Aunt Rosie character doesn't have to be a warm and fuzzy a person.
Well, who's, you were really listening, weren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to know, like, I think what you've brought to our world is so key. And people, I want people to learn that. Like, what is it about these Aunt Rosie characters? Was your grandfather, and then the whale rider. You talked about the grandfather in that story as well. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the clinical notion is not one I made up out of the blue. I really just stumbled across it in clinical work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was simply that I would hear every once in a while, even before I got smart enough to ask the question, I would hear about a character, a relative, a neighbor, the lady across the street, maybe even just an aunt that would come and visit once a summer. And I began noticing that the patient's affect would change when the patient, usually being a mother or father, him or herself, would change when talking about these people. And I began wondering, in the life of somebody who's suffered so much, could it be that many of us actually have somebody who is not like anybody else? The one male figure, for example, who could draw me up on his lap and would not molest me. The one female figure that was not drunk. The one person that seemed to look in my eyes when he or she talked to me, unlike my own parents who were so depressed or so otherwise gone affectively. And very, very slowly, I learned to start asking about that. Mm. Was there anybody else? Which, by the way, I found to be dangerous territory, because I never wanted the patient to think I was saying, okay, enough about the bad stuff, tell me a nice story. That wasn't my point at all. Mm. But I did want to know, was there anybody who stood for something in your life. And often I found people not only could think of somebody, but they could think of them very quickly.
Well, we have ways of asking that question. Like with Marty Glenn and I created this adverse early experience score. And then we developed a resiliency score. So we would ask, is there someone in your life who really was there for you, who really got you, who really, by whom you felt really listened to and understood? You know, sometimes it's not even a person, it could be a pet. We're looking for resourcing. And then, but when you talked about these characters, and I reflected on my own life, and this was something that we did with Myrna when I was her student, there for me and for a lot of people, it's the help that our parents hired. So there is a housekeeper in my life who, according to my mother, she said that this housekeeper would say, Kate's my baby. She's my baby. And she helped me learn to walk and, you know, all those early things. My mother was very overwhelmed. And so my body took her in as an imprint, as a positive. So when we're talking about positive, you know, what happens for us as children, as babies. And I loved your story of the Aunt Rosie because of the young woman that you were interviewing. Even in your upcoming book, the On Hollow Ground, I learned even more about that story, about how she was taking in, remembering being rocked and held. And that's a somatic memory.
Entirely somatic. And the queer thing about the Aunt Rosie idea is that, because I guess it is somatic, it doesn't have to last long. It's not as if someone had to be in your life for 3 years. Sometimes someone in your life for 3 days or weeks, and as was the case, I think, with the mom you're referring to, she was just a caregiver, evidently, at the orphanage where this mom lived, she thinks, when she was about 2. And the only thing she remembers about her is that she was black and that she wore a red bandana material fabric dress. But what she could really remember was the feeling of being in her arms.
Being held.
And she imagines, this was her language, that the woman was, for that moment at least, loving her. And since that stood out among all the other people that were using her, it was big.
Right.
And more importantly than just that it was big, it was the thing we could build our intervention on.
And in the story that you tell, I'm going to put it in our show notes for listeners, that you say this was a one time when you focused on the parent. And I didn't know if there was protocols that you did in these home visits where I remember you saying to yourself, I silently said to the children, I'll be with you next, but right now I have to do this. And it was a risk. Yes. You talked about it as a risk.
Of course, because this particular mother you brought up was harming those children.
Yes.
At the very moment we're doing this remembering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My job was, of course, not to do clinical treatment with the mother. My job was to get her to stop beating these babies, first of all,
right,
and to help the future be better. But there was no way to do that, except, of course, through the primary caregiver, the mother.
Could you summarize for our listeners just what happened in that story briefly? Because we've talked about it. You and I both know, but our listeners may not. And I'll put it in the notes for people to listen to. But summarize for people, and then I'd like to ask about another story.
Try to be brief. The situation was simply that she was with a fan belt, automotive fan belt, beating her toddler and 1-year-old, and that's why I was sent there by Child Protection. And I was making a home visit to which the mother appeared in a bikini, and she persisted in dressing like that for the first couple of sessions, which of course threw me for quite a loop. Mm-hmm. She was a very young, by the way, and very beautiful woman, I'll acknowledge. And I didn't, because that's how we were trained, I didn't ask her directly. I didn't say, please go put on clothes, or gee, that's inappropriate, or why are you wearing a bikini? Instead, I just asked about her. And what I slowly began to see is what probably I should have seen immediately, and our listeners could probably see, which is that she had, of course, been molested over and over and over again in multiple foster homes until finally at about age 13 or 14, she ran away. And so that is the shtick from her perspective. Shtick is a psychoanalytic word, you understand. For internal working model, meaning mm-hmm. that if a guy was coming, she needed to do the thing that she did when guys came.
Right, I remember.
And so as we were exploring that, she began to put on clothes for no reason that was obvious or that she was giving voice to. It was, in my view, unquestionably, was that she, in spite of the fact that she was showing no empathy for herself at all, she wasn't saying, oh, let me tell you a sad story. She was just talking about all these things that happened. I think she was slowly starting to think, wow, that's a lot of stuff. Nobody really cared for me, did they? Should they have? And really, she didn't have an answer to that question until she remembered that lady in the rocking chair. And there was something about remembering that that caused her to remember also that all children need that, and she needed that. And then bingo, if I needed that, could my kids need that?
Yeah.
All of this, by the way, I want to emphasize this, is unconscious.
Right.
It's not as if she popped up in the chair and say, oh my God, Mr. Trout, you are the most wonderful therapist in the world. I now see, no, none of that. It's just that I appeared for a home visit. And as we walked through the kitchen, I noticed the fan belt wasn't on the hook by the refrigerator where it always had been. And I asked her about it and she said, oh, I don't need that anymore. And I asked her about that. And she said, well, don't you know? That hurts kids. How did you know that? It hurts kids. Parents shouldn't do that. Parents should do this other thing. And she began describing what little children need.
Yeah, so there was, you really created the conditions there for her consciousness to rise up and grasp what happens with, for herself. I mean, you didn't come in there and lecture her. She found her way to that. Yeah. So
as usually happens in infant mental health work, there are several substrates all working at once. One of them was, oh my goodness, she's sitting in a room with a man and he's not touching her. And she's putting on clothes because she's having a new experience that we're not even talking about while she's having doing all this remembering and this sudden awareness of what little children need.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay. So her mental models are shifting. She's having new neurons, new neural nets start to fire. It's a new pattern that begins because of your presence and your capacity to be with and hold space. And I
wouldn't want listeners to think this was smooth, by the way. It was very bumpy.
Mm-hmm. How many visits did you do with her? Do you remember?
Probably a dozen. Mm-hmm. So in psychoanalytic terms, it was a very brief therapy.
I guess,
yeah. With her for some years. And she became quite a leader in a parent support group we had in this community.
Nice.
So I knew her for a while.
Nice. Well, how does it work when the person who's your Aunt Rosie is kind of not fuzzy and warm and holding you and rocking like your grandfather and the grandfather in the story of the Whale Rider?
Yeah. Well, the Whale Rider grandpa was at least not mean. He was gruff. My grandfather was mean.
But he still was your Aunt Rosie.
He was, because he wasn't mean to me. But he beat my mother and his firstborn son, who was named after him, Vernon Jr. But I came just about 8 weeks after Vernon Jr. had been killed in the Philippines at the end of the Second World War.
I remember, yeah.
And Grandpa, I think for that reason, took to me. Mm. Even though he was furious at my mom at age 16 for getting pregnant by me in the first place, he took to me. And while I don't think at all he rocked and cuddled and cozied up to me, he nonetheless loved me. And I'm pretty sure I knew that. I base that on how treasured he is in my memory, my reaction when he died, the fact that in my hall right now upstairs is a treasured photograph of him sitting in a huge Adirondack chair with little tiny me on his lap with his great huge boots on my feet. One of the intimate photographs I can imagine.
Would you be willing to share that photo? Just take a photo of it and send it to me?
Oh, I am. I can do that.
I would love to see it.
Yeah.
And well, it would invite listeners now just to feel a moment, someone who really loved them and their history. I would, and sometimes when I'm working with people, like here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live, horses, like it's a horse country. And so people are very loved. Their horses create that same reciprocal relationship of that person really cared for me. That was a really special bond. So yeah, I often sometimes will even work with places in nature, but it doesn't have the same feeling of that reciprocal loved place, like the people. He loved you, your grandfather.
But I love your persistence in using that word reciprocal, because it challenges our listeners to remember that this is not necessarily about a reciprocation that the baby can name or can even say for sure was there. It's just the reciprocal nature of that attachment is something that is felt. Yeah, you just put your hand on your center of your chest. That's exactly right.
It's in our body. Yeah. And it's a blueprint. It's like, it's our heart. We're hardwired for that. And when I'm helping people feel into what happened for them, I try to find that place. And I like how you said, well, this is not at the expense of the story of what's happened to you. And I usually will just say, I just try and find a place of that. I call it building coherency or positive state. But our relationships are really key.
One of the reasons I just told you about that picture that's upstairs right now is that there are, for people like me and gazillions others in the world who have such an Aunt Rosie in their life, but they don't know why exactly that person was so important. We grab on to those little symbols. Like, I really did sit on his lap, and I really did have his boots on my feet. And it's probably one of the reasons I treasured a story that Granny told me after he died, of a time when my mom and dad were sitting in the living room at Granny and Grandpa's. My parents were extremely young, and my dad had smacked me again, as he evidently did a lot. And Grandpa, who was a very large man and almost never spoke, got up slowly out of his chair. So Granny says, I don't remember any of this. I was about 7 or 8 months old, walked over to where my dad, who weighed about half of what Grandpa weighed, was sitting, and said in this low grumbling voice, "You will never touch that boy again." Mm. And turned around and walked back to his chair. And I knew that Granny was not blowing smoke, because that story resonated with me. I knew it was true. And one of the ways I know it's true is that I, a wimp, a pastor's son, a pacifist who never fought anybody and not brave, I am fearless. Nobody intimidates me. I walk in crappy neighborhoods all the time, and my friends think I'm crazy to be there, and so on through my life. And after I heard Granny's story, I thought, that's it. I carried Grandpa with me. nobody could mess with me because I've got Grandpa.
Thank you for pausing there. I was just feeling everything you were saying. And when I heard you tell the story long ago, like when I first started teaching at APA, I had this memory of this mental picture of your grandfather, because I was so in. I know the story of the Aunt Rosie is such a key story to help people. And so I am deeply appreciating. I like look forward to seeing the picture in any case. There is another, that looks like we don't have too much time left, but the other story is the infant coherent narrative. I mean, that story is really important. And when you started shifting to telling stories like that, like, I don't know, just about a year or so ago. I mean, I don't remember you doing that before. Tell us about developing the infant coherent narrative and why it's important.
Well, it's not probably earth shattering to anybody but me, a few other weirdos in the world. But because it's really not all that different from what Bowlby taught us 60, 70 years ago about the internal working model of the infant. Mm-hmm. And what Charlie Zena has done so brilliantly when talking about infant representations. But the only thing that I've added to it particularly is that there may be an intervention based on the fact that babies and prenates, I think, are always mentally active in trying to give meaning to their experience. And one of the ways they do that, the primary way, I think, is to build stories, narratives, to make it, I am fearful about making it too concrete, but something along the lines of, that happened to me because, or the meaning of that episode I just had with my mother inside of whom I reside right now, or that mother across the room, the meaning of what she just did is the following. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard that from patients and picked up on cues about it from babies for decades before I began wondering, is there any way to address those stories? Mm-hmm. Because they're often, by the way, erroneous. That is, they're not the correct interpretation.
No, it becomes the model. It becomes what's in your head about yourself.
And doesn't matter whether it was right or wrong.
Right.
Which, by the way, foster and adoptive parents could say to us quickly, they know what it's like to try to talk their child of trauma or loss out of believing that, for example, I, your 17th foster mother, I won't leave you. I will love you. I won't hurt you. And the child, of course, is utterly unconvinced. So it became of great importance to see, is there some way other than left brain ways, is there some way to change the mind of a child? And I decided to focus on the actual story itself, such as we imagined it was. Mm-hmm. That's very important because we parents, foster, adoptive, or birth, often don't know exactly what the child's story is. And adoptive parents often don't even know what the circumstances were. But what we're searching for by telling whatever we did know is, can the child hook onto that and build his own story? And then, here's the biggie, can the child on his own question it? Can he say, oh, I wonder if I made a mistake in deciding that all mothers will hate me, that all fathers will hit me, that all foster parents will molest me? I wonder if I made a mistake.
So the baby on the inside, the prenate, as well as the baby who's before the cognitive age of the cognition comes on at, like, what, age 2, right? The left brain starts to come on. They're making up stories about themselves based on their somatic experiences, their sensory perceptive experiences, right?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Stories so, without words.
Yes.
Which means just vague narrative ideas.
So give some examples of some narratives that babies will make up based on their experiences.
A child that I was terribly worried about because he was just doing awfully badly at age 5, told a whole bunch of these, but I'll just pick one. His mom was describing the failed adoption of a little girl when he was 2. So he was already in the family, and they tried to adopt this other child, and it broke down at the last minute. While telling me about that, the child begins to rock back and forth. He's on the floor. He's now 5, and he says, "Yeah, you left for 40 days." And the mom said, "No, I didn't. What are you talking about?" He said, "Yeah, when and then he gives the girl's name, when she was going to come with us, you left for 40 days." And the mom kept trying to correct him. And then it dawned on me first, and mom was reluctant to go there, that he was telling, first of all, the truth, factually, and that doesn't always happen. But he was also telling, more importantly, what it was like for him when his mother lapsed into a terrible depression following the adoption collapse of this little girl. She did leave for 40 days. She was depressed. He experienced her as gone. That had a great deal to do with why he is so desperate about her now and so rejecting of her now. He's sure that just as his birth mother rejected him, this birth mother won't reliably, this adoptive mother won't reliably be there for him.
Well, the tool of the infant coherent narrative is something that I've also picked up, and I've taught parents. I've taught them to make repair. So it's they look at some of the I map out their experiences and what happened in those, and then invite them to make state just little narratives, positive and identifying overwhelming things, and then saying I'm sorry. And I've made a series of messages about them, similar to how you operated. But I have felt like creating these messages, I've seen it really turn the relationship around that was so challenging. Now there's connection, and now there's regulation, now there's feeling of love, whereas before it was not. I mean, this infant coherent narrative is really important, I think. So what are your plans now with this? You're teaching, you said it, some more about it. So tell us a little bit more.
It just kind of preoccupies me now. I not only because I think it's intellectually fascinating, but feeds right into my pounding with any students that I have about the necessity to be curious and to wonder at all times. And this is a wonderful focus for that wondering. What could this baby be saying? If this baby could speak, what would she say to us? And if I can get foster, adoptive, or even birth parents interested in the same idea, I think it would be quite a breakthrough for many families. We're so busy trying to manage behavior, number one, or two, talk the child out of his crazy ideas. Instead, if they were only to wonder, what difference might it make?
Well, those are the those three skills that you talk about in the book, See Me as a Person, that you wrote with your wife, Mary, and we'll complete with a little description of this book. But we don't, I don't want to keep you too much longer, Michael, but this book is profound. I mean, you published it in 2012, is that correct? And I really have told all my students that this is your textbook, really. I felt like wondering and following and holding. Like, I also teach creating safe haven with families and with birthing families. This is like where my passion really is, helping professionals who work with birthing families and young families and families that are pregnant, families that want to have babies. I mean, this is the beginning. This is the root of the tree of if we're trees. And wondering what I liked so much about, and feeling actually, because I feel on the somatic when I read your book, wondering is that tool where you don't come in the space with your ideas. You wait for the ideas and the to emerge out of your person that you're with. Can you speak a little bit about that? Wandering, following, holding, and then we'll complete, because I loved this book so much.
I did too. In part because it was a deviation from my usual topics. My wife is a nurse who heads a company that tries to improve healthcare, particularly with regard to the relationship between the physician or nurse and the patient at the bedside, but also in clinics. And it arose out of a conversation we had once many years ago, where she asked, essentially, what is it, if you had to put categories and words to what you do when you walk into a room with a patient, what would they be? Why do you succeed in making relationships? And of course, what she was wondering is there any transmission of that possible to physicians and nurses who walk into a hospital room who are notoriously awful at making connection, except sometimes they aren't? And so another question she was really asking is, when they aren't awful at it, when a patient will later say, oh, that Dr. Jones, he just listens to me for hours and hours, and he didn't, but the patient feels that. Mm. Or when this nurse just connects with patients in a way that shortens their hospital stay, for goodness sakes. My wife wanted to know, why does that happen? How does that happen? Anything infant mental health has to offer, and of course it does, because we face that for decades. We walk into homes where people hate us, where the court has directed us to be there, and people do not want to be us to be there. They greet us on the porch with weapons or brooms or stairs. But it was my contention that it's really not rocket science. That doesn't mean it always works, but the basics of it are just incredibly simple, and that is that we enter with a blank mind. We enter with just full of curiosity and wonderment about what this mother's or father's or baby's experience has been. And we hope and wait for them to teach us.
Yes, you wonder if you really have to hold back from coming in the space with yourself.
And with your brilliance.
And with your judgment.
And so, judgment.
So that's a muscle. Like, I can feel that. When I read your book, I could feel that. If I could teach that to people, just wait, just hold, and know how to, when to put in an inquiry about what's happening, when to not say anything, when to just go, and don't come in the space, and just hold. And it emerges just out of, like you said, out of the woman who found Aunt Rosie. That's the most powerful, because if you come in with your diagnostic tool, then they're going to take that label and it'll become another layer. You want healing to happen. And your tools of wandering, following, and holding, I mean, are just so brilliant. And the way you wrote the book, you and Mary together, and then you completed with about the relationship was some kind of reflective tools. Mm-hmm. Which seemed very common in your field of practice. Can you talk just a little bit about that? That's a reflective supervision, reflective tools, right?
Well, if I understand what you're asking, I think this idea of wondering, following, and holding is utterly applicable to clinical supervision as well.
Right.
And it's partly, I speak about it because I'm tired, frankly, aggravated at the frequency with which I understand young clinicians to be in the hands, so to speak, of supervisors who mistreat them, who are really not interested in them, or who want only to, I think, abuse them by not wondering about their practice, not wondering what they did, instead correct them about what they did. Mm-hmm. And so reflective supervision, which I did not invent,
no,
is my way of doing about that is exactly the same way I go about working with the patient, which is to ask my supervisees about the session and then wonder with them about each and everything the patient said or did, and they said and did, including movements and slight tics and funny little things, coughs and getting up to look out the window, and all those wonderful things that people do to teach us how they are experiencing us. And I find supervision to just skyrocket when I can get supervisors to do it that way. Mm. By the way, just like patients often wish we'd pack it up and go home, supervisees also don't necessarily ask for this kind of supervision. They're perfectly happy on the surface to have their supervisor stop by every once in a while and say, hey, how's it going? Or even sit down with them and hear about a case and then say, well, you really should have done that. Mm-hmm. That works fine for everybody. If nobody wants to grow, and if the supervisee is really frankly scared to death of what the supervisor will say, it's good to keep it superficial. Mm-hmm. I'm being sarcastic there.
I'm a clinician, and I get supervision, and sometimes I just want them to tell me
what to do,
what I did wrong, and what I can do to do better. And the supervision model that we use is with Ray Castellino, which is very self-reflective. Like, what happens for you in the space? What comes up for you? Is there something out of your history that comes up with this family that you're working with? And it's nice to get some attention like that. It's nice to be listened to by my supervisors, who are Ray and Tara Blasco. I can't speak more highly of Tara, but I'm just appreciating, I'm very much appreciating you and your work, and dreaming of another, perhaps we could do another interview sometime just on these three skills of wondering, following, and holding. I never had found this book when I was preparing for this podcast. I just explored a lot, and I ordered this book. I hadn't seen it before. I guess at some point I went on deeper into my studies of studying birth and babies, and stopped looking at your website and dreaming about coming out to be with you. But this book is pivotal, and I don't know if it's used as a textbook anywhere, but
in healthcare, it is not in our fields.
Well, I feel like it's time for us to expand. I love this book, and I love your work, and I want to just really respect our time, and also very much thank you for coming on our show today. And I'll see you in Australia when we go out together to that Infant Mental Health Congress. Wonderful. And maybe you'll come back and be a guest again.
Like that.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A More Beautiful Life podcast. To support our show, please go to Patreon / A More Beautiful Life.